Yes.
Very well.
Just an introduction quickly, Your Honor. David Teclis of Morris Nichols Arching Tunnel on behalf of the Appalese. I'd like to introduce Mr. Lee Wilson of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. With the court's permission, Mr. Wilson will make the argument on behalf of the Appalese today.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. Scott Tucker from Shimmick-Cleese & Tkellis on behalf of Plaintiff Below Appalans. With me today is Dennis Shields from Cohn, Swift & Graff. He's been previously pro hoc and will be making the presentation with the court's permission.
Welcome to the court. Before you begin, when I start the clock, you'll have your full 20 minutes. The green light will switch to yellow. That means you're into the 3 minutes you've reserved, and you can continue speaking, but you will be using part of the time you reserved.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Dennis Shields from Cohn, Swift & Graff on behalf of the appellant, the Police and Fire Retirement System of the City of Detroit. Your Honors, we respectfully request that the decision of the Delaware Transferee Court dismissing this action be reversed and that the action be reinstated. At the very least, we ask that the matter be stayed until the appeals that are pending before the Second Circuit be finally decided.
So the briefs say that the Second Circuit is going to do something in June. Is there a more precise date?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I mean, we just filed our appellate brief last week. There is an expedited briefing schedule, but as far as I know, there's no argument date yet, and I can't ever say when the Second Circuit's ever going to decide.
They're not as predictable as we are.
I never know, Your Honor. Sometimes we've waited over a year for a decision from the Second Circuit.
That won't happen here.
In any event, Your Honor, you make a good point. I mean that the courts in this jurisdiction, the Chancery Court and this court, act promptly. And I think that one issue that is important here, not only with the internal affairs doctrine that is important to the state of Delaware, but also the importance of the expertise that this court has and the Chancery Court has in deciding derivative actions. This is a case I respectfully submit implicates very important issues of the internal affairs doctrine for this state. And this is the most important state in this country that deals with corporations, particularly since most of the corporations in this country are incorporated in this state.
But these claims,
yes,
that raise these issues that you're referring to are claims that belong to the debtor, correct?
They belong to the debtor, but they have always essentially belonged to the debtor. The derivative claims and the recovery that was always expected would be for the corporation.
Right, but the debtor is in federal bankruptcy.
The debtor is in federal bankruptcy.
As a matter of federal bankruptcy law, those claims cannot be pursued derivatively without the permission of the bankruptcy court, correct?
Under the law as it stands, that is correct. That is
and
correct.
You don't have permission of the bankruptcy court. In fact, you were denied permission.
And we've appealed that. That's correct.
So what we have is, to begin with, formally speaking, a lack of standing. Secondly, it's also the case, is it not, that as matters currently stand, your client has no economic interest in this claim?
Well, Your Honor, our client never had an economic interest in this.
Your clients were equity shareholders.
Equity shareholders, that's correct, Your Honor.
In a corporation that is underwater by $1.5 billion or in change, correct?
Through the wrongdoing, we assert of the officers that were sued 3.5 years prior to them filing for bankruptcy.
Okay. And so the only parties, the only stakeholders in this corporation who would have an interest in these claims would be the creditors at this point.
Well, I respectfully, that's an issue of fact that's been raised in the bankruptcy court, Your Honor.
Maybe an issue of fact, but your clients, there's no equity. And therefore, even if your clients were to recover, it would go for the benefit of creditors. Is that not fair?
Well, that's an unknown at this point, and I respectfully submit that's
unknown.
An issue of fact. I mean, I certainly agree that the bankruptcy...
Excuse me. Sure. It would go for the benefit of creditors to the extent that there's debt that is not the debt that's not paid, correct?
Under the absolute
at least $1.5 billion.
Under the absolute priority rule, Your Honor, is correct.
Okay. And the parties that would have a logical interest in pursuing this claim, if any, the creditors, are not objecting to these claims being settled.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the corporation.
Correct?
The creditors have not filed an objection. That's correct.
Okay, so the only party that's attempting to pursue these claims and objecting to the settlement on that basis is your client, who have no economic interest and no standing, correct?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, we're the only ones objecting. I still think I respectfully submit it's an issue of fact as to whether or not we would come down. But the real party in interest is and always has been the corporation. And with all due respect, we respectfully submit that the officers and directors that we've sued have been unjustly enriched by their wrongdoing. And that what we are seeking, and it always has been from the beginning, is that the corporation, and that's by virtue of the nature of a derivative action, the corporation would be the one that would recover. And what is important here, and what I'm trying to emphasize, is that this court has the importance of the internal affairs doctrine to make sure that, you know,
yes,
shareholders are protected.
If there were a party in interest that had standing and an economic interest in pursuing those claims under the internal affairs doctrine, then Delaware might have an interest.
Delaware has an interest, and we respectfully submit AMBAC has an interest.
The interest that you're referring to is really academic as far as your clients are concerned. It's abstract, isn't it?
Well, as I said, it's an issue of fact as to how much could be recovered. I mean, there's other issues as to coming down and taking that strict absolute priority rule. But we respectfully submit, Your Honor, that since we brought this case, if any amounts could be brought into the estate that are greater than the cost, this action should proceed, particularly since the wrongdoers, who are still the same officers and directors that ran this company into the ground, are still in the positions that they were, essentially abandoned these claims.
Help me understand one of your earlier answers to Justice Jacobs' question. Do you or do you not need permission from the bankruptcy court to pursue this claim in state court?
Either from the bankruptcy court or from some other court. I do agree to that under how it is.
All right, so if you need permission or authorization from the bankruptcy court to pursue this Court of Chancery claim and you don't have it, why do you have standing?
Because, Your Honor, we have raised an appeal, and we respectfully submit that the bankruptcy court really does not have jurisdiction under the Stern versus Marshall matter to really, you know, have this. I mean, this is where the Stern versus Marshall matter really throws this matter into flux. I mean, you know, we have appealed it. It's our position that this has been abandoned. The bankruptcy court had no jurisdiction to decide whether it had jurisdiction, and that's one of the issues that we're raising. And if you look, and this is where the internal affairs doctrine comes in with the play of the bankruptcy court, is that, you know, under the Agostino case that Chancellor.
Go ahead. You have an appeal to the Second Circuit. So far as the matters stand, there are final judgments that adjudicate that your client has no standing.
That's
to pursue
correct.
These claims. That judgment is subject to an appeal to the Second Circuit, which has not yet ruled.
That's correct.
If the Second Circuit rules against you, that is, affirms, and that judgment becomes final, then these claims go away, right? I mean, your action is...
Well,
we
certainly have the right to file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court also.
It goes to the Supreme Court and they deny cert. It becomes final. This matter is over. Is that correct?
For all intents and purposes, yes, Your Honor.
So isn't it fair to say that it's up to the federal courts to decide whether you belong here or not?
Your Honor,
this
is where I'm trying to emphasize that it's important for this court to assert the importance of the internal affairs doctrine and the interplay between the bankruptcy laws and this court.
Well, we understand the importance of the internal affairs doctrine. We also understand the importance of the supremacy clause. And what you have here is a situation where there is a supervening federal authority that has the power to decide whether you are properly in this court. And that authority, so far, has said you don't. And all we have... the only question mark at this point is whether that will be upheld by a higher federal authority.
Well, Your Honor, when you talk about the supremacy clause, it also goes into an interplay between the bankruptcy laws and this court.
Well, there's no question about the interplay.
Well, there is an interplay. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
You know, the internal affairs doctrine is the doctrine that justifies the state, a state, creating in a, you know, by a judicial decision at the very least, the rules that govern the relationship between fiduciaries and their beneficiaries in the corporate context. That is overlaid, at least the enforcement of it is overlaid by the Bankruptcy Act, at least where the subject corporation is in bankruptcy. And you seem to be treating this case as though that reality is not there.
Your Honor, with all due respect, but the Stern versus Marshall case, I think particularly that last part of the opinion from Chief Justice Roberts, wherein he mentions Section 28 U.S.C. 1334, that provides for the bankruptcy courts to send matters to the state courts for decision. I think that's very important, and that's the framework, even within the supremacy clause, that's being neglected and perhaps overwhelmed by the bankruptcy courts, and perhaps is an indication to this court why it's important for your honors to emphasize why the internal affairs doctrine is so important, and particularly a case like this where we start a case.
That's an argument you need to make to the circuit court, isn't it?
And to this court. I mean, with all due respect, I mean, this court is the court that governs oversees the fiduciary duties of those directors of most of the corporations here in the United States of America. And to say that the state has an important interest in that should emphasize to the bankruptcy courts that if there is a matter dealing with state law, particularly one that augments in the state.
We already have a final judgment. By a federal district court that this case doesn't belong here. It should not be allowed to proceed. How can we, in effect, circumvent that judgment? What power do we have?
Well, Your Honor, it is on appeal. And as I said, it can also be held in abeyance instead of an outright dismissal. But also, Your Honors, what I'm also trying to emphasize is that for example, state insurance matters are important for the state, and that's why insurance matters are held or dealt with, particularly like if there's a receivership by a state. In fact, the subsidiary of Ambac in this case was an insurance company, and a receivership is being held in Wisconsin. So it's the same sort of thing with 1334, that to the extent that we have an important state interest, particularly overseeing the fiduciary duties of directors, that this court emphasized to the bankruptcy courts, don't just extinguish the claims, particularly when the people who are extinguishing the claims are the people that are being sued. I mean, there is an irreconcilable conflict here.
Can I talk for a moment or ask you for a moment about your interest as opposed to this court's or the state's interest in this matter? There are or were other derivative actions filed asserting the same claims that you have asserted, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There was another case in Delaware, and they were consolidated here in Delaware. And there were cases in New York in the federal court.
And those other consolidated derivative claims were settled, correct?
No, Your Honor. No, the derivative claims? No. It was the class action securities case that alleged that the officers that AMBAC engaged in misrepresentations that were disseminated to the public. That was the federal case, and in fact, that case survived the motion to dismiss and was the case that was settled in federal court. And as part of that settlement, as a condition for settling that case, they are releasing and dismissing this completely unrelated derivative case, which is also another basis of our appeal, saying that that is an overly broad release. It violates the National Super Spuds decision.
And you objected to that settlement?
We objected to that settlement, yes, Your Honor.
Did the attorneys in the other derivative actions receive any attorney's fees as part of that settlement?
The derivative attorneys, no. No, Your Honor. There has been awarded to the class action lawyers in that case. And I don't know whether they've been paid or not. I don't know whether it's a so-called quick pay provision or not. But they were awarded attorney's fees. Not the derivative case, but the attorneys that were representing the plaintiffs in the securities case.
And part of that settlement did not include those attorneys prorating or in some way distributing some of their attorney's fees to the other attorneys?
To the derivative plaintiffs?
Correct.
No, Your Honor. They, in fact, well, in any event, no, Your Honor. And there has not been any offer from them to do so either. But we respectfully submit that that's another issue, that they were settling, you know, the securities case. They had no authority to settle the derivative case, and that's one of the basis that's part of our appeal. And we also respectfully submit, and another reason why the bankruptcy court erred, is that by pushing or piggybacking the security settlement with also getting rid of the derivative case, that they lowered the standard for our case to get dismissed. Our case was stayed here in Delaware, so we did try to intervene in the New York case, but that was denied.
But isn't it, I wouldn't say routine, but it's not uncommon when there's a settlement of a corporate claim that involves both federal securities law claims and state claims, that the settlement encompasses both of those sets of claims, correct?
As far as I know, Your Honor, that wasn't asserted. There wasn't any state claims asserted from my recollection in the securities case.
No. What I'm saying is that when there's a settlement and there exist both state and federal claims, not in the same complaint, but out there, as in the case here where there were derivatives, state derivative claims and federal securities claims, is it unusual for a settlement to encompass even those claims that are not in front of the U.S. District Court?
Well, to the extent that there's a release, there's a National Super Spuds case that comes from the Second Circuit that basically says that you can only give a release that's as broad as the relief that you could get in the action itself. So that's the National Super Spuds case, and that's a judge-friendly decision. Now, I think Your Honor might be referring to something like the Matsushita case that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, where I believe there was a release given the state court and how it might have affected federal claims. But
so
that's always subject to, excuse me?
What's your answer then?
My answer is that this release was too broad. I mean, and I think it needs to be looked on a fact-by-fact basis as to whether the release is too broad. And we respectfully submit in this case, the release that was gotten by the plaintiffs in the securities class action here is overbroad. And not only that, by piggybacking our case onto the security settlement, that the bankruptcy court applied a lower standard. Instead of the Twombly standard, for example, they used the Iridium factors. And there, instead of holding whether or not we had to allege some kind of plausibility, we were held to the standard of essentially having to meet a preliminary injunction, a likelihood of success on the merits. And therefore, that made us, you know, given us a greater hurdle. And that's also one of the subjects of the appeal. And all this also comes down to the Stern versus Marshall case, which I get
okay.
back to, is that all
Let's
this is
stop,
going to be reviewed.
Stop.
Okay.
Stop.
Sure.
When you say that all of this is going to be reviewed by the Second Circuit.
We've raised it with the Second Circuit,
okay.
Correct.
What if the Second Circuit agrees with you? Would it matter that we had already affirmed the dismissal of this case?
Well, I think that I would be in two things. One, I think I would have the right to bring a Rule 60 motion. I think our Vice Chancellor Laster pointed that out towards the end of the argument.
So in other words, you wouldn't suffer irreparable injury if we went ahead, just as the trial court did here, and rendered a decision on this matter?
Well, I would have to go with the Rule 60 motion then, but also just from a selfish reason, is that the Police and Fire Retirement System of the City of Detroit is the only one that's been pursuing this so far, or has continued to pursue it. And certainly, if the Second Circuit does reverse, I'd certainly ask that the Bankruptcy Court refer this matter down to the Chancery Court, where we could try it there instead of competing with any other plaintiffs, derivative plaintiffs, that had brought a suit but have not pursued these appeals in these matters. From the selfish reason, I certainly would like to say I have the active case.
And the
that
court
is seeking
decide
this.
whether to agree with you or not, right?
Whoever would decide that. I mean, from your lips to God's ears, I hope that would happen. But in any event,
But what I'm trying to get at is that there seems to be no reason, compelling or otherwise, why we should withhold a decision here or enter a stay in the trial court and say that the trial court should have entered a stay, because all of your concerns are going to be raised in the Second Circuit, and if the Second Circuit agrees with you, then you'll be able to get relief.
Well, on the flip side of that, there's nothing pressing to reach a decision instead of just keeping it stayed and pending the decision of the Second Circuit. You know, that's the flip side of that argument. But by the same token, if this court were to rule on this issue, I respectfully submit that this is an opportunity to emphasize how important the internal affairs doctrine is, the balance between the bankruptcy courts and this court, and that by emphasizing how important it is, particularly in this where we have wrongdoers that were sued 3.5 years prior to them filing for bankruptcy, and everything that we alleged came to fruition, and that they were the ones that stayed in. I think my time is up. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lee Wilson from Wachtell Lipton on behalf of the defendants' appellees. I thought, Justice Jacobs, it's a very important point to consider all of this in light of the fact that appellant PFRS claims to hold a total of 100 shares of AMBAC common stock out of 300 million outstanding shares, all of which are subordinate to approximately $1.7 billion in unsecured debt in AMBAC's bankruptcy. In March of this year, the bankruptcy court confirmed a plan of reorganization under which the equity holders get no distribution from the estate. And so it's very much unclear what, if any, real interest appellant PFRS has in the AMBAC claims at issue in the action below. Making this all the more, PFRS's pursuit of these objections all the more quizzical is the fact that they're the only objector currently to a settlement that resolves a variety of claims involving AMBAC and its officers and directors, including the AMBAC claims that were asserted in the action below, and that this is a settlement in which the AMBAC Creditors Committee, the holders of the $1.7 billion in unsecured debt senior to the equity holders, the true parties in interest, after performing their own independent analysis, as found by the bankruptcy court, supported the settlement as in the best interests of the estate. The settlement has now been approved over PFRS's objection at every step. They objected in the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court approved the settlement. They appealed that decision to the district court. The district court heard the objections, all of the same objections that they raise here today, and rejected those. And it was also approved separately by the district court as part of the judgment approving the settlement of the securities class actions. And PFRS appeared there.
Two questions.
Sure.
Does the approval by the district court obviate any issue under Stern versus Marshall? That's the first question. Second question is, we know that the judgment at the district court level is going up to the Second Circuit, and the question is what, if any, timetable can be predicted, hazardous though that may be, in terms of when a decision from that court might come down.
Sure, Your Honor. With regard to the first question, one of the issues that they raise in their reply brief for the first time is that is the novel argument that this court should not give full faith and credit to the bankruptcy court's order because it lacked constitutional authority to decide whether or not it even had constitutional authority. The case law is clear. The Underwriters National case says that you have to give res judicata or full faith and credit effect even to the jurisdictional decisions of another court. And the bankruptcy court clearly addressed the jurisdictional arguments they're raising here and overruled them.
I understand that, but...
Yes. And then, I'm sorry, I am going to get to your question. I apologize, Your Honor. To the extent that they're saying that that decision, that jurisdictional decision by the bankruptcy court, is not entitled to full faith and credit because it lacked authority, the district court on appeal reviewed that jurisdictional decision de novo. And it reviewed that decision and found that, in fact, the appellant PFRS was wrong. And, in fact, the bankruptcy court did and affirmed the bankruptcy court, finding that it did have the authority to approve the settlement pursuant to Federal Rule 9019.
Right, and my question is that that's a judgment by an Article III court.
Yes.
Does that Article III court judgment satisfy whatever requirement might be imposed, if any, by Stern v. Marshall?
I believe that it satisfies any requirement that could possibly be raised as to why this court should not give full faith and credit to the bankruptcy court order. PFRS is appealing the district court's order to the Second Circuit and arguing that the district court itself was wrong. So I suppose it's possible. We certainly don't think there's any merit in their Stern v. Marshall arguments, but if the Second Circuit overruled the district court, that might lead to questions about the bankruptcy court's order. But at the moment, we have a final order that has been approved by the district court, and that is entitled to full faith and credit in this court. And so I do believe it cures the only issue that they've raised on appeal to giving full faith and credit to the bankruptcy court's order. With regard to your second question, Your Honor, right now, as we did in this court, in the Second Circuit, we move for expedited treatment of PFRS's appeals. There are two appeals. They have an appeal from the judgment of the district court approving the settlement of the securities class actions, and they also have their ongoing appeal from the bankruptcy court order approving AMBAC's entry into the settlement, including the releases of the AMBAC claims in the action below. All of those appeals are now before the Second Circuit. They've been consolidated into one appeal. And in response to our motion to expedite, the Second Circuit issued an expedited briefing schedule. Appellant PFRS has filed its opening brief. It filed that on April 26th. And right now, the order says that the case is scheduled to be heard the week of June 25th. And I, as Your Honor said, this, as you may know, the Second Circuit can sometimes take a while to act. But it's also very unusual for the Second Circuit to issue an expedited briefing schedule like this that basically has the original brief being due in April and the case being heard in June. It is a very busy court, and it has a lot of cases. So I think the fact that it's issued this briefing schedule indicates that it treats this seriously and is going to review this on an expedited basis. And just leaping off from that, that's also the reason why PFRS's argument here that this court should stay its determination is without merit. As Justice Berger recognized, there's no harm to plaintiff PFRS if your honors affirm the order of the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery specifically noted.
Well, you agree, though. If we affirm the Court of Chancery and the Second Circuit reverses, and then they would go back to the Court of Chancery and file a motion to open the judgment.
They very well might, but I think there are actually quite a few steps in between. If the Second Circuit reverses, presumably it would go back to the bankruptcy court, and whatever the Second Circuit says, or the district court, they would have to, again, seek leave from some court to pursue these claims. And I think that's another important point, is that none of this, none of what's going on in the Second Circuit has anything to do with the standing argument. The standing argument is an independent basis for dismissal. Upon AMBAC's filing for bankruptcy back in November of 2010, appellant PFRS lost standing to pursue these claims. And for that reason alone, the action should be dismissed until they get leave from some other court to pursue these actions on, to pursue these claims on AMBAC's behalf. All of that is independent of what's going on.
How would that work in your mind? Would they try to file the Rule 60 motion, or if they got permission to bring the claim, would it be filing a new claim?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure of the answer to that question. As Mr. Shields indicated, presumably the procedure would be that in the bankruptcy court, or if the bankruptcy court is held not to have constitutional authority in the district court overseeing the bankruptcy, they would seek leave to file these claims. If they were then granted leave to file these claims, they could petition the court to pursue the claims here. Maybe the court would allow them to choose where to pursue the claims themselves. But the key is that they have to obtain leave from another court.
I understand that. But you represented to us, and the record is mm-hmm. consistent with your representation, that in approving the settlement, the bankruptcy court looked at these derivative claims, mm-hmm. decided they weren't worth pursuing, that it was proper to include them in this global settlement, for mm-hmm. want of a better term. So I assume the logical extension of that fact in the record is if the Second Circuit reversed and they go to the bankruptcy court and say, we'd like to go pursue these derivative claims in Delaware court, they would be met by an argument that said these derivative claims don't have any merit.
I mean, that's already what's happened here. I don't think that that's what the Second Circuit reversal would change. I think what it would change is whether or not the bankruptcy court could make that determination, or whether or not it had to be a district court that made that determination. You know, the bankruptcy court could give findings and recommendations.
I understand. Independent of and so the district final authority, somebody's going to have to decide before they give permission to go to the Delaware Court of Chancery that it's an exercise worth undertaking.
That's correct, and that's definitely the way that it should be. These are AMBAC's claims that are part of the AMBAC bankruptcy estate, and there should be a centralized authority that makes determinations under federal bankruptcy law as to how to handle the in rem property of the AMBAC estate. No one's disputing that these claims are part of the AMBAC estate. So if it were the district court who made that determination, and just to emphasize, neither the bankruptcy court nor the district court is adjudicating these claims, determining whether or not in the final event they have merit. What they're doing is they're analyzing a settlement under standards set out by the Iridium decision in the Second Circuit. They're looking at various points, and one of those points is, you know, the likelihood of success on the merits in these claims. But it's not the same inquiry that would go into deciding the claims in the final analysis.
We understood that, and that was clearly presented in the briefs.
That's correct.
Just one detail that I want to pin down. We understand that there are several issues being presented to the Second Circuit. Is it your position that the formal standing of the plaintiffs to pursue these derivative claims is not before the Second Circuit?
I think that
that specific issue.
The bankruptcy court, I'd first like to say that the bankruptcy court found that appellant PFRS never formally sought leave to pursue these claims in the bankruptcy court. They showed up in the bankruptcy court and objected to the settlement and argued that it didn't make sense. And during that argument, they mentioned that they would like to pursue their own claims that they had pre-existing, but they never filed a motion to seek leave. And so I'm not even sure if technically it is before the Second Circuit, their motion to seek leave, whether that's been decided. However, the bankruptcy court, in listening to their objections, noted that they never formally sought leave, but then nonetheless went on to decide that they do lack standing, that this is not an appropriate case for a granted distributor
okay, so
standing.
So there was a determination. All I'm asking is that
that was
determination
appealed
on appeal to the Second Circuit?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
But again, just that determination, in a sense, that should also be given full faith and credit. That's separate from the bankruptcy court's determination that the settlement should be approved. And the standing argument is independent of anything that the bankruptcy court did. Even had nothing ever happened in the bankruptcy court, from the moment AMBAC filed for bankruptcy, they lost standing. And the case law is clear on that. Thorson, in this case, there are multiple, in the Delaware Court of Chancery, there are multiple cases from the Second Circuit. And then just to go back to the stay point that this court should withhold a decision, I think it is important, one, to remember that appellant PFRS does own 100 shares and has never presented any reason why it has a real interest in this case. And so that should definitely be taken into account in deciding whether or not to stay this litigation. Second, the standing argument is independent of what's going on in the Second Circuit. That's primarily an appeal of whether or not the settlement, the bankruptcy court should have approved the settlement, whether or not the releases were too broad, whether or not there was constitutional authority to do so. None of that changes that until plaintiffs do get leave to pursue a claim in this court or to pursue these claims on behalf of AMBAC.
Well, then you're telling us that the standing, the formal standing of the plaintiffs is not an issue in the Second Circuit.
Again, I don't think that they have sought leave to pursue the claims. The court did determine that this is not a situation where they have standing. So it is before the Second Circuit. They're still arguing that they do have standing. But
yeah, well, if it's either before the Second Circuit or it's not. If it isn't, then that's one thing. If it is, and the Second Circuit reverses on that point, what's the consequence for us?
I think the point that I would make, if the Second Circuit reverses, it's not going to order that they have standing, because they haven't sought leave. It may find that the bankruptcy court was correct, that there isn't a justification for standing here.
It reopens the issue. Is that
okay? It would reopen the issue, and it would be back in either the bankruptcy court or the district court, presumably.
Does all of this relate to the automatic stay, or is there something else operating here?
It all relates to the automatic stay, the Section 362 stay, but there's also extensive case law that says that upon the commencement of a bankruptcy, under federal bankruptcy law, the property of the estate is with the exclusive jurisdiction, is the exclusive jurisdiction of the debtor and the bankruptcy court, and that the property of the estate includes the estate's claims. And so that's related to the automatic stay, but I think it actually goes beyond that as well. And then just back to the stay point, the one other point I'd make, as we said in our motion to expedite before this court, and I realize this court denied that, perhaps partly because you hear the case on a fairly expedited schedule anyway, was that one of the conditions to AMVAC emerging from bankruptcy to the effectiveness of its plan of confirmation is that the settlement has become effective. And one of the conditions to the settlement becoming effective is that all of the various appeals have been resolved, and so we're seeking to get those resolved in the Second Circuit and are moving forward on an expedited basis here. We would also request that Your Honors act on an expedited basis to decide this appeal so that when AMVAC is ready to have the plan of confirmation go effective, and their current intent is sometime in the third quarter, that they can emerge from bankruptcy without these outstanding appeals. And I think as PFRS's conduct to date has shown, it's very possible that they may decide to petition for cert. In this case, they may decide to petition for cert from the Second Circuit's decision. And it simply would be inequitable to allow a party that has no real interest in these actions to hold up AMVAC's emerging from bankruptcy simply on the grounds that it's again, the only reason I can think of for them pursuing all of these appeals, given their lack of interest, is to try to extract some form of attorney's fees, as Your Honor recognized. And in the derivative context, in this context, they have to add some sort of substantial benefit to the company to be awarded any attorney's fees. There's no indication that they've done so here. The company found that these claims should be settled, and there's no indication that they're deserving of ever anything. And to hold up this appeal process and to hold up AMVAC's emerging from bankruptcy would simply be inequitable. If Your Honors don't have any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shields, we only had 30 seconds left. We had a lot of questions, so I've set the clock at a minute if there's something you'd like to tell us in parting.
Yes, Your Honors. Just 3 points. One, with respect to the district court's decisions regarding the bankruptcy, I respectfully submit that doesn't rectify the deficiency in Stern versus Marshall, because the district court did not apply de novo review of findings of fact, which I respectfully submit at the very least under Stern versus Marshall would be required. Second, the standing issue is before the Second Circuit. I did ask at the August 10th hearing for permission to be appointed to pursue, to have the stay lifted and to pursue the matter. Now, that wasn't formally, but we didn't do it previously because we were stuck with the stay. I mean, we certainly, you know, so, and even when we, you know, raised these objections, they were saying, hey, you can't do anything because you're interfering with the reorganization, so we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. And finally, I just want to mention one thing regarding abandonment. There is insurance involved, and there is plenty of insurance still involved even after the insurance is being kicked in for a portion of the security settlement, and that's been left on the table. And if that's another indication that I wanted to emphasize, it's an abandonment of the claims by the directors here, who are the same directors that were in power when we sued.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments. And the court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess. Mm-hmm.